The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. I hope everyone's doing well today. We're going to start with an article from the wellness section. What if we could opt out of menopause entirely? A scientist researching ways to extend the life of our ovaries thinks we're not far off. The ovaries are the central command of women's bodies, directly impacting heart health, brain health, immune function, and more. So why are they the only organs we simply let fail? Pyrae Bime, PhD, is determined to improve ovarian health and research via her company, Cellmatrix, a women's health organization developing therapeutics based on what makes women's bodies unique. Here, the molecular biologist demystifies HRT, talks menopause misconceptions, and explains exactly why ovarian function is essential to overall health. Why do you call menopause a public health crisis? For women who have a life expectancy that is decades beyond the end of their ovarian function, it is the single biggest accelerant of unhappy aging for women. Examples of unhealthy aging are the things that we associate with aging in general: cardiovascular disease, dementia, autoimmune disorders, obesity, insulin resistance, diabetes, etc. These things we assume are just happening because we're aging, but what we know now from the science is that these things are accelerated by the end of ovarian function. A lot of women don't realize that. Why is ovarian health crucial to overall health? The ovary and ovarian function are related to cardiovascular health, to brain health, immune function, mood, weight gain, metabolism, virtually every aspect of our health. The ovary and the factors that it emits communicates with virtually every cell in your body. When the ovary is not in balance, when ovarian health is not functioning correctly, it can impact in virtually every aspect of our health and wellness. How should we be thinking differently about menopause? Many people consider menopause, which is when the ovary stops functioning, to be a natural phenomenon. But the reality is that it's a completely modern phenomenon, and it's a consequence of how successful we've been in other aspects of healthcare. 100 years ago, most women died before the age of 50 with a fully functioning ovary. Now, the average lifespan for a woman in the United States is over 80. Given the ovary stops functioning around 50, that means that not only are we outliving our ovarian function, but we're outliving it by decades. We can't just normalize menopause and consider it a natural phenomenon. That's a rite of passage. We have to see it for what it is, which is public health crisis, the end of the function of a critical, vital organ. In a refreshingly candid conversation with Oprah Daily Insiders, Oprah, Maria Shriver, Drew Barrymore, and Drs. Sharon Malone, Heather Hirsch, and Judith Joseph, we set the record straight on all things menopause. If you become an Oprah Insider, Daily Insider now to get access to the conversation and the full Life You Want class library. Again, in wellness, we have why I chose flat closure surgery. In breast cancer parlance, women who opt out of reconstructive surgery are called unicorns. This writer recently became one. And this article is by Francesca Olson. At my first surgical consult, after learning I would need a mastectomy, I was offered lots of information about reconstruction after breast cancer, part of the deluge of information that stuns you after diagnosis. I'd spent much of the time since diagnosis crying, staring into space, and making phone calls to set up things like my first chemo infusion. Adding reconstruction to it all seemed like a lot of work, especially for someone whose life had just been compressed into chaos. What if I just want to be flat on one side? I asked. Can you do that? It's your choice, but we want to make you whole again, the surgeon said. I was stunned. My wholeness comes from inside me, not from what my body looks like. It felt insensitive for him to tie my state of being to my physical form, especially when my physical form was in peril. Out of chaos comes clarity, and this was one of the times in my life where I knew exactly what to say. There is nothing anyone could do to make me not whole, I told him. That turned out to be truer than I knew at the time. I had been diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer at age 35, the day after my daughter's first birthday. Even at the mammogram appointment, when I learned I had cancer, when a radiologist took me into the viewing room to look at the tumors growing inside my breast and lymph nodes, my heart whispered that I knew was the truth. Reconstruction was not for me. Looking at those images, I had a visceral feeling. I wanted this out of me as soon as possible, in the simplest and fastest way forward, no extras. Before I could undergo surgical intervention, I needed chemotherapy. In between the rounds of treatment, I spent a lot of time soul-searching, thinking deeply about my options and their potential consequences, and mourning the body I knew was going to change forever. While I considered all options and even attended a consult with a plastic surgeon for due diligence's sake, I never really wavered. Ultimately, I wanted to preserve as much of myself as possible. After giving birth via C-section in 2021, I wasn't excited about DIEP flap surgery, where fat is taken from the abdominal region to form breasts, and implants turned me off because it felt like putting something inside me that wasn't mine to begin with. I also spent a lot of time online learning from the experiences of other women in breast cancer groups. What I learned was shocking. While we often feel pressured by our family, friends, doctors, and society to become whole, a recent study of almost 85,000 women found that more than half opt not to pursue reconstruction. That study doesn't include women who chose to explant, remove breast implants, after experiencing complications, discomfort, or illness post-reconstruction. There are tens of thousands of women, perhaps hundreds of thousands, who have chosen either single or double aesthetic flat closure, or AFC, and are living happily with that choice. One major factor in my decision, and one I've seen come up again and again in breast cancer groups, was my commitment to being a joyful, active mommy. I want to be able to swing my daughter from side to side and let her dance on my feet for as long as I can. Someone who is always ready to sweep her up into a big hug. Ultimately, I chose the surgical option that would expedite those big hugs. Knowing that I could be cleared to pick her up after 10 days was an important factor. So, in November 2022, I became a unicorn. In breast cancer survivor lingo, someone who opted not to undergo reconstructive surgery after her mastectomy and instead pursue single-side AFC. Double AFC folks are often referred to as flatties. I am completely flat on my left side, and I have a 7-inch scar that runs from my chest up into my armpit. It may seem strange at first glance, and in fact I've gotten a lot of strange first glances, especially at the beach, but I have no regrets. There isn't anything wrong with reconstruction. It's also a valid choice, but it's not the only choice. This is one of the most personal decisions you can ever make, and there's no right way to be. However, patient across to information about AFC is lacking, which means plenty of women aren't learning about something they might want during one of the most vulnerable points in their lives. One study by the Medical College of Wisconsin found that many women surveyed learned about flat closure online from other patients, not from their care team. AFC is a simpler surgery with a shorter recovery window. Mine was done by a general surgeon, not a reconstructive surgeon, but it's often seen as less desirable than reconstruction. Breasts are firmly tied to womanhood for a lot of people, and the idea of taking them away is often frowned upon. A 2021 study found that nearly 75% of women surveyed who had no reconstruction were satisfied with the results, but almost 25% said their surgeons didn't support their decision. There's even an organization, Not Putting on a Shirt, that helps women find flat, friendly surgeons in their area, a direct response to hearing from so many women who got pushback while pursuing AFC. It's been almost a year since my surgery, and I still feel good about my decision. I spent the first 6 months feeling a bit self-conscious, looking around to see if anyone was staring at me, but it's surprising how quickly you can get used to such a big change. I don't wear a prosthetic breast, though many do. When I look at myself in the mirror, I see someone who will fight to the end of the earth to stay alive for her family and herself. I am more deeply myself than I was when I had two breasts, kinder to myself after experiencing 15 months of trauma. I don't care if people see what happened to me. These days I'm experiencing a new kind of wholeness, one that transcends physicality. I like to joke that now that my left breast is gone, my heart is closer to the world. That feels like something worth sharing. Still in wellness, this article is the most common eating disorder you've never heard of. Binge eating disorder affects more than 3 million Americans. It's time to talk about it. Susie Denby says she remembers starting to binge eat when she was around 10 years old. There was one time when we had just gotten home from a pool party. As my mom was unloading the car, I kept grabbing handfuls of crackers that were on the counter and running up to my room to eat them. By the time she was done, I had finished the whole box. My mom was so angry with me, she says. I've always been a really anxious person, and looking back now, I see that food helped me regulate that fight or flight feeling. What began as occasional episodes got worse as she got older, Denby says. In her first year of college, she found it hard to connect with the other students at her large state university. Plus, she was diagnosed with polycystic ovary syndrome and put on a severely restrictive diet. I would go home on the weekends and just start eating because it felt like a release from all of this pressure. Plus, it provided comfort, at least for a short while, she says. After she graduated, her eating started to get unmanageable. The death of a loved one while she was still in school and another soon after mired her in grief. As a result, Denby found herself binging at least every week. Whenever I felt that heightened feeling of grief and sadness, anxiety, or anger, I knew food could bring me down. I ended up turning to fast food because it was so easy to access. Plus, it was easy to eat in my car by myself. I'd go to the drive-thru on my way home from work. It wasn't until she found herself purging one day after a binge that it occurred to her that she might have an actual eating disorder. That was in 2018, and when she sought treatment later that year at age 27, she was surprised to learn that she was dealing with a condition called binge eating disorder. Binge eating disorder, BED, is the most common eating disorder in the United States, yet remains the overlooked middle child compared to its better-known siblings, anorexia nervosa and bulimia. This despite the fact that BED occurs at more than twice the rate in the general population. Estimates vary, but according to the National Institute of Mental Health, approximately 3% of the U.S. population will have dealt with a disorder at some point in their life, while only 1% or less will have experienced bulimia or anorexia nervosa. One reason it's under-discussed is that the disorder only officially entered the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM, the tome clinicians use to classify mental health conditions, in 2013. The DSM is also what health insurance companies look to when considering covering treatments. Adding to that lag in classification is the lingering myth held by clinicians and individuals alike, that people who binge simply lack the willpower or self-control that others have. Quite the contrary, says clinical psychologist Marnie A. White, PhD, a professor of social and behavioral sciences in the Yale School of Public Health, and a specialist in BED. Individuals with binge eating disorder are also often chronic dieters, so they can show high degrees of dietary restraint. Unfortunately, that restraint often triggers more binging, and with it, shame and guilt that can perpetuate the behavior, says Samantha DeCaro, Director of Clinical Outreach and Education at the Renfree Center on Eating Disorders Treatment Center with 21 locations around the country. Many people who struggle with these episodes do end up attributing them to a problem with willpower. They think that if they could just be stronger, maybe they'd be able to fix it. But they don't realize they're actually dealing with a disorder, and once they learn what the disorder is, they realize that this is not their fault and that it has nothing to do with willpower and that it's not a choice. So what is binge eating disorder? To be diagnosed with BED, a person must meet the following criteria. They eat a much larger amount of food in a short amount of time, for example, within 2 hours, than what other people would eat under similar circumstances. They feel a lack of control over what or how much they eat during the episode. The episodes are associated with three or more of the following: eating much more rapidly than normal, eating until feeling uncomfortably full, eating large amounts of food when not feeling physically hungry, eating alone because of feeling embarrassed by how much one is eating, feeling disgusted with oneself, depressed, or very guilty afterward. They feel significant distress and upset about their binge eating. The binge eating occurs on average at least once a week for 3 months. It isn't associated with self-induced purging, vomiting, or laxative use, excessive exercise, or fasting to compensate for the binge, nor does it occur exclusively during the course of anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa. It's also important to note that binge eating is not a single occurrence of overeating, like Thanksgiving dinner or Super Bowl Sunday, where people intend to consume more food than usual. What causes binge eating disorder? Researchers are still hammering out theories, from the behavioral to the genetic. On the behavioral end, a leading argument is that it's a form of emotional regulation. Says White, eating provides short-term pleasantness, and we learn this from day one. What do we do when a baby's crying? We give them a bottle. So we learn to soothe through food. What happened is that individuals who have difficulty processing certain emotional experiences and who also lack adaptive coping strategies like sitting with negative emotions and recognizing them as part of the human experience turn to binge eating to try to forget these feelings and make themselves feel better. Tammy Weiser, 60, says that exactly what binge eating did for her when she started having episodes around age 21. I had started law school in a new state, but within pretty short order, figured out I didn't really like it and didn't think I wanted to become an attorney. After about 3 months of deep despair, I thought, well, if I'm not going to quit, I'm at least going to eat whatever I want. So I started driving by the grocery store on the way back from school. I'd fill my cart with all the things I thought would make me feel better, and then eat them in the car. I ate jars of marshmallow fluff. I mean, who eats that? But it made sense to me, says Weiser, who has been in recovery since her mid-50s. Marshmallow fluff actually makes perfect sense, since the human brain is hardwired to like foods that are really tasty, meaning they're dense in calories and have some component of sugar or fat, or both, says eating disordered researcher J. Andrew Hardaway, Ph.D., an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral neurobiology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. So when people binge eat, they're usually not binge eating on quinoa and kale salad. That's because, evolutionarily speaking, sugary or fatty foods are meant to engage our brain more effectively than quinoa. Those caloric-dense foods are not only good for stored energy, they also trigger parts of our brain connected to emotions and enjoyment, like the amygdala and the release of hormones like dopamine, which is tied to our feeling of reward. When I ate everything went blank, kind of like when you paint all the walls white in a room, recalls Weiser. It calmed me down and made all the worries go away, and I'd feel better, at least temporarily. On the genetic front, scientists have found that BED is heritable, meaning it runs in families, and shares some genetic factors with obesity and being overweight, says Cynthia Bullock, B-U-L-I-K, Ph.D., distinguished professor of eating disorders at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine, and one of the leading researchers on the genetics of eating disorders. While BED is more common in people who have overweight or obesity, up to 30% of people with obesity also have BED, and on average begins in one's mid-20s. It can show up in people of all sizes, shapes, genders, and ages. We know that about 40 to 50% of the risk of developing a binge eating disorder is due to genetic factors, says Bullock. You have risk genes, you have buffering genes, which are genes that can actually reduce the expression of whatever genetic risk you have. But then you also have environmental risk factors, like maybe your household happens to be one that has a lot of junk food available, and you have environmental buffering factors, like you come from a family that really encourages physical activity. Depending on which you have more or less, all influence your risk for the development of binge eating disorder. Bullock and other researchers hope that one day their research will lead to targeted drug therapies to prevent or treat BED. But in the meantime, Bullock says, no one should think of it as a biological inevitability. Yes, recovering from an eating disorder is an uphill battle against your biology, but that doesn't mean you can't get past it, says Bullock. There are skills you can learn from psychotherapy and other places that can help you through it. What does treatment look like? Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, is considered the gold standard, largely because several randomized controlled studies back up its success in treating binge eating disorder. Other therapies include interpersonal psychotherapy, a form of talk therapy that happens in individual and group formats, and dialectical behavioral therapy, which, like CBT, helps patients create a toolbox of skills to manage their disorder. Some treatment centers, like the Renfrew Center and individual therapists, offer what experts call a transdiagnostic treatment model. Our approach is rooted in CBT concepts, but there are a lot of other components, like mindfulness, where you learn to be present with your emotions in a non-judgmental way. We also incorporate yoga, art therapy, and exposure work, where you gradually reintroduce foods or experiences that you find scary or triggering to help conquer those fears, says DeCaro. Denby, who is now 32 and in recovery, found that Renfrew's day treatment program helped her tremendously. She also said she found help in online recovery spaces. The National Eating Disorder Association lists some, and connecting via TikTok or Instagram with experts promoting intuitive eating, like fitness coach Alex Joy Pucci. That's P-U-C-C-I. As of now, only one drug has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration to help treat binge eating disorder. Vyvanse, that's V-Y-V-A-N-C-E, which is often used for ADHD. Both disorders involve low impulse control. Certain antidepressants, anticonvulsants, which can help stabilize mood and also help reduce impulse control problems, and anti-obesity medications may also be prescribed to patients, though they don't work for everyone, and if they do, might only help in the short term. The goal, says DeCaro, is finding a treatment that helps the patients not just stop binging, but also feel better in general. Even if we can pinpoint exactly what triggered the eating disorder, it's not as powerful as identifying the things that are maintaining it. Once you do that, you can create an environment where it can't thrive anymore. Both Denby and Weiser say therapy was the key to their recovery. As part of her treatment, Weiser and her therapist, Dr. White at Yale, structured a regimented plan that included finding alternative activities like crocheting that could give her the sense of satisfaction and completion she once craved from food. For Denby, working with experts led to a breakthrough. At first, I was mad when a therapist wanted me to focus on the emotions I was having when I turned to food. I didn't want to know, but it was a big turning point for me, she says, describing the shift like a physical release in her body. Now I get what this disorder is. I've learned the skills for tolerating those emotions and recognizing that they don't last forever and that you don't need to fight them as much as accept that they are there. Now I can stop myself and think about the ultimate consequence of my actions rather than the immediate gratification. Over in books, we have Matthew McConaughey shares three books that made a difference. The actor looks back on books that made a lasting impression. Matthew McConaughey can now add children's book author to his impressive resume. The actor, whose 2020 memoir Green Lights was a number one New York Times bestseller, says that the idea for Just Because, out now, came to him at 2:00 in the morning. It was a ditty, a song that I woke up with in my head. I got up and just started writing it down, he says. Just because they threw the dart doesn't mean that it stuck. And just because I've got some skills don't mean there is no luck. I just started writing all these couplets. It was stuff that my own children had been talking to me and their mother about, things that they're confused about, frustrated about trying to figure out. McConaughey says that he hopes the book will help facilitate meaningful chats between parents and their kids. It's a way to have digestible, easy conversations with our kids that may otherwise be hard to have, he says. As McConaughey releases a book he hopes will make a difference, we asked him to reflect on some of the books that have had the biggest impact on him. Here's what he said. The Greatest Salesman in the World. Sometimes we seek books and sometimes they just find us. This book found me when I was at the University of Texas, at a time when I was really struggling with what my career path was going to be. I was a liberal arts and psychology major. I was going to become a lawyer. I had been kind of not sleeping well with the idea of being a lawyer, and I was like, I think I want to go into the storytelling business. But the idea of being behind or in front of the camera was just foreign to me. I was at a friend's house, and this book was under a stack of Sports Illustrated and Playboys. I picked it up and read the prologue. I went to find my friend who was sleeping in his bedroom. He had been up all night cramming for an exam, and I said, "Hey, can I borrow this book?" And he, kind of groggy, woke up and looked at it, and he goes, "No, you can have it," he goes. "My dad gave that to me, and he told me to hand it off to someone who needed it later in life. That's yours." That book helped me form an identity. It gave me confidence and courage to make the choice. It was only 2 weeks later that I called my father and said, "I don't want to go to law school. I want to go to film school." And the book is called The Greatest Salesman in the World by O.G. Mandino. Next book was Self-Reliance and Other Essays. Emerson's essays, Self-Reliance and the Oversoul in particular, also made a major impact on my life and my confidence. They were such a lightning bolt in my life that I could read two lines and I'd have to shut the book and go, "Whoa, I got to take a walk for a few days and try to put this philosophy out there and see what kind of reverb I get back from the world." Self-Reliance is like 17 pages and it took me 2 months to read it. Self-Reliance and Other Essays is by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Next one is The Holy Bible, King James Version. The Bible has been very important to me. I'm the last one to forgive myself. Check out Ecclesiastes if you have this affliction. Ecclesiastes taught me empathy and forgiveness. The times when I think maybe everything I'm doing needs to be so important, it reminds me, hey, there's a season for everything and you need to ebb and the flow. You need the dark and the light. You'll fail and you'll succeed. And that's the rhythm. There's time for everything, so it really lets the air out of the pressure that I'll put on myself. And all of the three books he listed can be found on Amazon. We're in relationships now. This article is entitled 17 Smart Ways to Make Friends in a New City, according to experts. Moving to a new place can feel overwhelming, but these tips make things a little easier. So, you unpacked all the moving boxes and filled your pantry with groceries. You even have new curtains and light fixtures on the way. But just because your house is starting to become a home doesn't mean your new city really feels like home yet, especially if you left friends behind. It can seem overwhelming and lonely to try and form a new circle, but trust us, with time, you'll develop new relationships while you keep in touch with your long-distance pals. We spoke with Lewis Elliott, a certified life coach, and Samantha Kane, a New York City-based psychotherapist, for tips about making friends in a new city. After all, we are in the midst of what the Surgeon General is calling a loneliness epidemic, so it's important to forge through initial discomfort and build new friendships. Community is a lifeline. It's a human need to feel and to be connected with the world around us, says Elliot. Having friendships with people who live around us helps nourish that part of our human need for connection. From being invited to go run errands to a more formal gathering like Friendsgiving, Local friendships play a key role in helping us avoid those feelings of loneliness and isolation. Making new friends after moving somewhere, especially as an adult, is justifiably daunting, he says. It can be emotionally exhausting and takes a real effort. So let's give ourselves some compassion. There are plenty of ways to meet people and build new friendships, and what works best will vary based on your personality, hobbies, schedule, and more. It's important to remember that however you decide to go about expanding your network, it may feel like work at times, but there should be something enjoyable about it. Otherwise, it will likely be difficult to keep up, says Kane. Whichever approach you take, be curious and ask questions, and once you've established some common ground, initiate the next step. For those next steps, keep reading. Number 1. Remember, everyone deserves and is worthy of great friendship. When we embark on making friends, our insecurities come out of the woodwork, says Elliot. Thoughts like, will they like me, and am I cool, are valid. But remember that they are fear-based. The first step is reminding yourself that you are worthy of the connections you crave, and be open to the people who gravitate towards you. Number 2, embrace the awkward. There's a strong chance making a new friend will feel a bit weird and forced at first, and that's very natural. It's okay to be transparent about it, says Elliot. Sharing that you're a little nervous can be liberating. And chances are, other people looking for friends are just as nervous as you. So if you're making small talk at the gym or a book club, know that it could lead to something much deeper. Change is typically uncomfortable, he says. However, it can, and often does, lead to an even better future. Number 3. Ditch the urge to be a people pleaser. When those insecurities about being funny enough, cool enough, or whatever enough really start to get at you, it's easy to hide certain parts of you or even fib about your interests to make yourself seem more likable. It will feel good at the beginning, but relationships that don't start out authentic often fizzle out, says Elliot. Don't waste your time or theirs. Be you. The qualities you think make you weird are exactly what some people are looking for in a BFF. Number 4, set goals. You can extend your goals to your friendships. Creating and tracking small goals will build towards your larger goal of making new friends, says Kane. For example, you may want to set a goal to talk to someone new once or twice a week, or go to alumni networking events 3 times this year. Working toward and reaching these smaller goals can help you focus on the progress you're making. It can also be helpful to find ways to celebrate reaching your goals, says Kane. She says that this is a great tool for people who are introverted or neurodivergent. Number 5. Get creative when making plans. Elliot suggests ditching the mentality that bars and other largely populated events are the only good places to meet a new friend. So many of my clients will say things like, but I'm not a bar person, so I'm doomed. There is a social world outside of alcohol, so think outside the box when inviting an acquaintance to hang out. Take a walk in the park. See a free concert. Take a pottery class. The world is your oyster. Number 6. Lean on your existing network. Setups can be platonic too, says Kane. Tell your friends and family that you've moved and ask if they know anyone living in the area. Your old camp friend, former roommate, or cousin may have a great friend to connect you to in the area, she says. Also, don't discount sending an Instagram DM. People are more receptive to friends than you might think, especially if you have a few in common. Number 7. Remember that you don't have to drink. If you're open to bars but not a drinker, ask for a mocktail, says Elliot. A lot of people feel uncomfortable abstaining from booze when they're around a lot of people who are drinking, and that's fair. Check in with yourself, and if you don't want a million questions about why you don't have a drink, grab a mocktail to hold. Might we suggest, though, not spending a whole lot of time with people who bother you about not drinking? Number 8. Get involved in your new community. Have fun exploring your new city and yourself. Consider getting to know community members while participating in a neighborhood running or walking group, volunteering for a local organization you care about, taking a photography or cooking class, getting involved in local politics, or dining solo at the bar and chatting up fellow diners, says Kane. After you do a few things by yourself, you'll be more confident about joining events alone. Number 9, chat to people whenever you tend to spend time. Start with your passions and hobbies. Making friends is going to feel more natural when the environment is full of familiar things you know you can talk about, says Elliot. This helps alleviate some of the anxiety about what to say because you already have common ground. Number 10. Remember that you actually do know what you're doing. There's a very slim chance that prior to moving to your new city, you never had a friend. But it's easy to forget that when your whole life just did a 180, we know how to make friends. What we don't like is feeling uncomfortable or the idea that we may be rejected, says Elliot. Number 11. Schedule time blocks for socializing. For introverts, social activity can be exhausting. I invite individuals who are introverted and looking to build new friendships to consider scheduling a block or blocks of time each week dedicated to working toward this goal, says Kane. This way, she says, you can plan ahead and prepare yourself mentally and emotionally. Number 12, go for groups. Your weekly hobbies could be huge pools for potential friends. I've met people in weekly fitness classes, gaming cafes, and life coaching events, and at each of these events, I didn't necessarily go into them eagerly looking for friends, says Elliot. Once I started seeing the same faces at my weekly or semi-consistent activities, I felt the confidence arise to take a chance and share a smile, a joke, or a simple good morning. Take advantage of the social pools you've already exposed to, such approaching as a coworker, someone in your exercise class, a frequenter of your favorite coffee spot, or another dog parent at the dog park. Number 13. Try something new. For you social butterflies, take it to the clubs and bars, join a kickball league or a community-sponsored event, suggests Elliot. Whether you're an introvert, an extrovert, or an ambivert, there are plenty of new things to try that are outside your comfort zone, but not so much that you close yourself off. When I didn't have any friends after moving to a new city, I went to drag shows, he says. It was easy to be in a group of people, and I would choose to connect with others or just focus on the show without getting too in my head about being there alone. Number 14. Download an app. If you are on the introverted side and the idea of making the first move, IRL, feels too scary, there's an app for that. Several, actually. For those more introverted, try options like meetup apps and websites that help you ease into things, suggests Elliot. Why? Well, apps like Bumble, BFF, allow you to choose friends like you choose dates. And events you find on Facebook or Eventbrite will have a description, how many people will be there, the duration of the event, and even what you should prepare so you know exactly what to expect. 15. Change your mindset. If you go into the situation thinking it's going to be awful, you're setting yourself up for yucky feelings, and there's a slimmer possibility for an enjoyable time, says Elliot. A nice reframe, he says, is acknowledging making friends as an adult feels super weird, and that's okay. If it helps, pick up a journaling practice and allow your fears and apprehensions to flow on the page, and then leave them there. 16. Don't discount work events. Work-sponsored events are great social opportunities for introverts as well. It's easy to get the invite, everyone has a common connection, and it's appropriate to leave whenever you want, says Elliot. Plus, bonding over shared work wins or frustrations can create a basis for trust and deepen those connections. 17. Don't be afraid to seek help. Living in a new city can be really exciting and fun, and it can also come with challenges. There may be times while you're growing your network that you feel very lonely, says Kane. Acknowledge the difficulty of the process, honor your feelings, and commend yourself for the effort you're putting in. If the loneliness persists and it's impacting your mental health, I recommend scheduling an appointment with a licensed mental health professional, she says. Over in culture and news, Sweet Magnolias fans, Netflix just released news about the show's future. The third season of Sweet Magnolias dropped on Netflix back in July, and since then, fans have been wondering if the show is going to return for season 4. After all, the final episode left fans with some unanswered questions, but no major cliffhangers like in past seasons, so it felt like the series could end. Joanna Garcia Swisher said, "Even though the season ended with a nice button, it almost feels like it was a necessary button to really dig in deep for the future. There's still so much to be told, so it almost feels like a cliffhanger in itself. But we have good news. We're heading back to Serenity. Netflix officially announced on October 19 that the show would be returning for a fourth season. The streaming service quietly dropped the news on the Netflix family Instagram account, with no other details except the caption, "Sweet Magnolias has been renewed for season 4. The post was paired with images from the show's third season. There's no word on when the show will return, as it's dependent on the ongoing actors' strike. But now that it's been given the green light, the writers can get back to work on dreaming up what's next for Dana Sue, Maddie, and Helen. There's too much up in the air to predict when new episodes will air on Netflix. Season 1 premiered in May of 2020. Season 2 was released in February 2020, and Season 3 dropped in July of 2023. We'll remain hopeful for a summer release, but stay tuned for more details." Still in culture and news, Adele reveals she quit drinking 3.5 months ago. Adele, whose album 30 contained a song called "I Drink Wine," is no longer imbibing any alcoholic beverages. The singer revealed over the weekend that she quit drinking months ago. "I stopped drinking quite a long time ago. I stopped drinking. When did I stop drinking? It feels like forever. Maybe like 3.5 months ago," she told the audience at her Las Vegas residency show in a video shared on X, formerly known as Twitter. "It's boring. I mean, oh my God, it's boring. I was literally borderline alcoholic for quite a lot of my 20s, but I miss it so much. I cut out caffeine, so enjoy your whiskey sour. I'm very, very jealous," she told an audience member. Adele has been open about how much she enjoys drinking in past interviews. She told Vogue in November 2021 that, "I've always had a very close relationship with alcohol. I was always very fascinated by alcohol. It's what kept my dad from me, so I always wanted to know what was so great about it," she said. She spoke to Oprah that same month about not drinking at the time. "I stopped drinking," she sharing. "That's one great way of really sort of getting to know yourself, is just drinking water and being sober as anything." Oprah also pointed out that Adele had a fascinating relationship with alcohol, which she agreed with, citing that it was because it took my dad from me. Mark Evans, Adele's father, died in May 2021 from bowel cancer, but was absent for most of her childhood, per People. Her parents divorced when she was just 3 years old. We're in books, and this is The Bizarre True History of Love Potions. While the romance treatments of wellness may be totally made up, the real history of love potions is stranger than fiction. Falling in love is hard work. Staying in love might be even harder. Instead of subjecting yourself to the tyranny of dating apps or the labor of couples therapy, what if there were a pill or a potion that could deliver you straight to your happily ever after? Well, Elizabeth Augustine, one of the protagonists of Oprah's 102nd book club pick, offers her clients just that. Sort of. Elizabeth, the loving mother and conflicted lover at the center of wellness, works for a company that offers placebo treatments to unsuspecting patients. Trust me, this is less malicious than it sounds. Elizabeth's fake treatments often provide real results without the nasty side effects that sometimes accompany more active pharmacological interventions. Along with treating complaints such as headaches, mental fuzziness, and stress, Elizabeth offers a cocktail for perhaps the most devastating malady of all, the broken heart. The treatment, known around Elizabeth's office as Love Potion Number 9, can be administered in the form of intranasal dopamine sprays, or oxytocin patches, or testosterone gels, or cleansing estrogen scrubs, or pheromone nebulizers, depending on which form is likely to be most convincing to a particular patient. Author Nathan Hill came up with these ideas after reading a paper with the deeply sexy title, "Could Intranasal Oxytocin Be Used to Enhance Relationships?" It was written by researchers at the Oxford Center for Neuroethics and the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Research Institute, and that data inspired all those other totally made up love potions. Is there a love potion that could work on the author himself? "I'm an oyster and martini kind of guy," Hill admits, Call me old-fashioned. The love potions of wellness may be invented, but the history of romantic enhancement is all too real. Read on for some of the most unforgettable remedies. Fatal attraction, toxic brews in the ancient ages. For as long as humans have experienced love, we've been trying to figure out how to hack it, concocting potions that promise to turn the mystery of love into a definitive science. These enhancement techniques were invariably disgusting. See medieval love cakes baked with a wooer's sweat, and often toxic. Indeed, as Lisa Perrin explains in her lavishly illustrated The League of Lady Poisoners, the word venom may have originally derived from Venus and referred specifically to a love potion. This meaning later evolved to include remedy, potion, and invariably poison. This evolution makes sense when you look at the early days of love potions. The ancient Roman philosopher and poet Lucretius is rumored to have been driven mad and eventually to death by a love potion administered by his own wife, Lucilia. Though it is not known precisely what ingredients Lucilia may have used, the so-called Spanish fly, which is neither Spanish nor a fly, was commonly used in ancient Greek love potions. Roman gladiators and empresses alike observed that, when ingested, the bug or crushed beetle produced a warm, fuzzy feeling throughout the body that they assumed to be the fiery burn of fresh passion. In reality, the feeling was most likely caused by inflammation. The species contains a deadly toxin that can blister the skin or contact and kill when it's consumed in high enough quantities. Definitely not a girl's girl, a witchy seduction in 17th century Versailles. Perhaps the most infamous purveyor of love potions is the ravenously beautiful and venomously cunning Madame de Montespan, who, according to Eleanor Herman's best-selling book Sex with Kings, spiked King Louis XIV's meat and wine with a disgusting concoctions made of dead baby's blood, bones, intestines, along with parts of toads and bats in order to win and keep his love. Born to one of the oldest noble families in France, Madame de Montespan was determined to woo the notoriously philandering king. Montespan was the reigning beauty of King Louis XIV's court and a royal flirt. Despite her good looks and Louis's notorious philandering, she was unable to catch the king's eye. "She tries hard," he told his brother, "but I am not interested." Oof. But, like Blondie, Madame de Montespan was definitely not the kind of girl who gives up just like that. She cozied up to the queen and managed to weasel her way into private parties with the royal couple. Over the course of these meals, the king seemed to magically change his mind about the lady. She became his official mistress and mother of 7 of his children. The secret to Montespan's seduction came out through the 1679 investigation of the famed sorcerer Catherine Montvoisin, who was arrested in connection to a slew of Parisian poisonings in 1679. During her trial, many whispered that she had one particularly high-profile client, but Montvoisin kept her lips sealed for the rest of her short life. She was burned at the stake in 1680. It was the alleged witch's own daughter who revealed her connection to the king's most famous mistress. As Herman writes, Louis finally understood why, for 13 years, he had awoken with a headache every morning, and after he dined with his beloved mistress, Montespan was permitted to stay in Versailles, but the king's visits to her became rare, and he never ate or drank anything she offered him again. Your love is my drug, literally. In wellness, Jack and Elizabeth fall in love by observing each other through their apartment windows. In the late 70s, psychopharmacologist Alexandra Shulgin proposed that a very different window might help people connect. In his private garden shed chemistry lab, he synthesized and personally sampled a drug that seemed to eliminate fear, break through his habitual thinking patterns, and allow him to see clearly into the world as it truly was. A quality for which he nicknamed the compound Window. Today, that formula has earned a few more nicknames, including MDMA, Molly, Ecstasy, and, of course, the love drug. Side effects may include extreme cuddliness, enhanced empathy, and zapped resentment. As the American divorce rate skyrocketed in the early 80s, couples therapies began experimenting with what seemed at the time like a pharmacological love potion. While the then unregulated drug showed early promise in reigniting that finicky marital spark, it wasn't long before it spread from the therapist's couch to the warehouse rave party. In 1985, the DEA officially banned MDMA, listing it as a Schedule I substance, with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. In the decades since, you'd have a better shot of finding this alleged love potion in a Skrillex mosh pit than a pharmacy, but all that may be changing soon. As psychedelics enter the mainstream, thanks Michael Pollan, more and more experts are advocating for the therapeutic use of ecstasy, including in couples therapy. Perhaps the micro-dosed MDMA tinctures that Elizabeth advertises to the dissatisfied betrothed of wellness aren't as far off as they seem. In wellness, navigating the emotional weight of body image issues. From shame spirals to friends who ditch you when you drop pounds, the psychological toll of weight struggles is real. Leading psychologist Lynn Saladino, PSYD, lends her expertise. I've struggled with obesity my entire life and recently lost a significant amount of weight. Rather than cheering me on, a few of my friends have been critical, saying that I'm not the person I used to be. I don't want to lose my friends, but I am hurt and angry that they're not being supportive. How can I broach this with them? It's completely understandable that you're hurt by these friends, but prior to bringing things up, consider this. They're likely 100% correct that you're not the same person, and this isn't a bad thing. Being in a significantly smaller body can be like living a brand new life. For example, you may talk about yourself with poor confidence, consider dating different kinds of people, or pass up a boozy Sunday brunch for a game of pickleball. These changes may lead to having less in common with old friends. When you decide to have a conversation, start by choosing a time and place where you'll both be clear-headed. Let them know how you've been feeling and resist the urge to convince them you're the same person if that doesn't feel true for you. You may express that you're going through some trial and error as you get used to living in a new body, a process you'd welcome them into if they could be supportive and respectful. Listen to their concerns as well. As are they worried you're growing apart, tired of hearing about your diet, concerned you're going out on so many new dates? Evaluate whether their concerns have your best interest in mind or just their own. There's no guarantee this kind of conversation will save a friendship, but it'll help you establish with clarity how you'd like to move forward. In the past couple of years, I've gained 60 pounds. I feel terrible about myself and refuse to even change clothes in front of my husband. Our sex life has plummeted. He hasn't brought it up, but he has obviously noticed. Should I say something? I would recommend speaking with your husband about how you're feeling. While partners vary in their ability to be supportive, a conversation may help you work together to create a supportive environment for your path to feeling better. Before sitting down for a chat, get clear on what you'd like out of the discussion. Are you looking for support and reassurance, or do you solely want to express yourself? All of these are reasonable goals, but getting specific gives you a higher chance of success. Stating your objective might sound like, I've been upset about my weight and would like to talk about it. I don't need you to solve the problem, but it would feel good to have your support. Partners tend to jump to solving mode, so it can be a relief on both sides if that's taken off the table. During the conversation, try to stay present and limit assumptions. When we're feeling vulnerable, we often try to confirm beliefs we already hold. For example, if your husband says he thinks you look beautiful, but he's worried about your health, you might hear, he thinks I can't take care of myself. To help make it more productive, take the conversation slowly and stick to the facts. Involving a partner in your health journey is a very personal decision and depends on a lot of factors. Regardless, talking about it may help you feel less alone and decide on your next steps towards feeling your best. I've read all the science about obesity and understand that there may be a medical reason that I am carrying an extra weight, and yet I still feel like a total failure for being overweight, like I should be able to just stick to a diet. How can I shake this failure mindset? Shaking the failure mindset can be really hard for several reasons. In a system where success is solely measured in pounds lost, people who naturally hold extra weight are destined to miss their goal. In addition, yo-yo dieting resulting from unsustainable options lead most people to feel there's something wrong with them. But now we know that you aren't a failure. The system you were working within was flawed. To help you move past this, it's time to redefine success and commit to your health in a way that helps you feel confident. The failure mindset is often linked to inconsistency, so swap out strict diets for new health goals that are based on consistency. Reconsider options you may have tossed aside because they didn't make the scale budge, like 15-minute workouts or eating whole foods that include carbohydrates. When your goals are achievable, you're more likely to succeed. Next, expand your definition of success. Bodies that are well cared for often look and function better, so rather than a number on the scale, aim for things like improved energy, skin, confidence, and thought patterns. The goal of losing weight may never completely leave you, and that's okay, but consistently contributing to your health in ways you're proud of will help you shake that failure mindset once and for all. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Here are a couple of scary stories that you might be interested in, and when books. The Left-Right Game, adapted into a podcast in 2020, The Left-Right Game's first incarnation was as a post on No Sleep subreddit, where users submit fictional stories often framed as urban legends. The Left-Right Game quickly garnered a reputation as one of the most elaborate, unexpected, and downright terrifying entries ever. It's about a supposedly harmless game which can be played on any old suburban road. This one is called Selfies by Lavi Tidhar, T-I-D-H-A-R. If you're looking for a small story that packs a big scare, check out this imaginative riff of a fixture of the modern age, the cell phone. A girl buys a smartphone that happens to have pictures that foretell her own doom. This one is called Abraham's Boys by Joe Hill. Joe Hill comes from horror pedigree. His father is the Stephen King. With this short story and all of his novels, Hill shows his own distinct but equally chilling style. Abraham's Boys is about the sons of the Dutch vampire hunter Professor Abraham Van Helsing. The sons have no idea who their father really was. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.